This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Ryan Mitchell has been cooking Eastern Carolina-style whole hog barbecue for most of his life. He's a pit master from Wilson, North Carolina, and the son of barbecue legend Ed Mitchell. Father and son recently published their first cookbook together titled Ed Mitchell's Barbecue. And in it, they not only write about the mouth-watering dishes they've mastered over the decades, but also about their family's tradition and the complicated relationship that Black Americans have had with barbecue over generations. So today, we're going to talk about that history and about the art of cooking whole hog. And Ryan Mitchell joins us from Raleigh, North Carolina. Ryan, welcome to On Point.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
We are very excited to have you. And I want to start, if we could, with the story that your father writes in the book of the moment that changed his relationship with barbecue in 1991. Can you tell us that?
I can. First of all, in 1991, we lose our family hero, which is my grandfather. And at that particular time, my grandparents were, you know, running a corner store, if you will, bodega neighborhood grocery store. We sold, you know, fresh meats and cheeses and all the things and beverages. And so, you know, my grandmother's love language is cooking and feeding the neighborhood and feeding the churches and you know, just giving people food all the time. You know, that's her way to spread her hospitality. And so once my grandfather passed away, you know, we were really just in search of a way to try and, number one, figure out how we were going to save, you know, that particular piece of property and, you know, the family estate. And number two, you know, give my grandmother an out, you know, a form of therapy to continue to, you know, feel like she mattered to the family and you know, that we were going to continue to need her prayers and leadership as we got through losing my grandfather. So, you know, that particular summer, you know, we started, we cooked a pig just as a family dinner, you know, so to say, because her, you know, they were retired, so they would cook. She would cook dinner on little hot plates in the back of the grocery store just as their family dinner, as their routine before they left out for the evening, so they would get home and just relax. And so that, you know, she continued that same, you know, that same routine. And we cooked a little family dinner that evening, and it was really just meant to feed myself, my two uncles, and my dad, and, you know, a few other late family members that may stop by and continue to pay their condolences or whatever. And so we cook a small pig that day and a few sides, and, you know, we locked the door, and we begin to, sorry, we didn't lock the door first. We begin to have a family meal, and right before we lock the door, a customer comes in, you know, that last customer as you're finishing up the day, and he grabs, you know, a juice and some bread and, you know, another beverage, adult beverage, and he looks over and notices that, you know, there's a little pail of food of barbecue sitting on the meat counter. And he says, "Hey, can I get a sandwich?" And, you know, my dad kind of looks over to him like, "Man, what are you talking about?" He's like, "You know, the sandwich of barbecue over there." He's like, "Man, that ain't for sale. You know, that's family dinner. You know, mama's just back there making stuff, you know, for us to eat and get out of here." And so my grandmother pops up her head. And she's like, "Just give him a sandwich. He can have it." And so we at her request, we give this gentleman the sandwich, and he pays for his beverages, and he walks out the door into the neighborhood. And so we proceed to lock the door and just continue to get out of there. But right after we lock the door, there's a rattle at the door. And it is two or three more other people. Well, this guy went down the street and told the neighborhood that we were selling barbecue, right? So, which was not the case, you know. So, you know, we had customers from the neighborhood rattling the door, and we get up to the door and say, "Hey, man, what's going on?" We were thinking somebody trying to break in. And the guy behind the door says, "Hey, we heard you guys were selling barbecue. We're just trying to get some." And my dad looks over, you know, confused, like, "What the heck is going on?" My grandmother pops up and just like, "Hey, just tell them we'll have some tomorrow. Don't worry about it." And so my dad, you know, relays that message through the door. And along comes the birth of Mitchell's Ribs, yeah. Mitchell's Barbecue, yeah. Mitchell's Rib Chicken and Barbecue. The next day, five customers. The next day, you know, continue to grow.
Yeah.
So, well, but mind you, we had no, there was no elaborate business plan to be trying to sell barbecue. It was just something that we were good at and known for as a family.
Yeah. Yeah. And so there's so much in that story. I just want to dig a little deeper, Ryan, because
absolutely.
First of all, you know, as you said, this was triggered by the passing of your grandfather, right? So there was this profound loss, not only for you, but especially your dad. I mean, the way he writes
very
about
much.
It, like the patriarch of the family when he lost his father. And then also your grandmother, you know, your dad's mother, mm-hmm. trying to hold her life together, and especially the store, right? Because
right.
it was
the store.
Yeah, it was the source of security, of meaning, of bringing the family together. The business was really, really important. And you, in fact, I love this image of you, like, since you were, what, seven, and they turned over old Pepsi crates so you could work
Yeah, we purchased the soup. You know, my grandparents retired, and fortunately, you know, my grandfather's, you know, once he retired from the state, his, you know, he continued to keep working, and he was like, you know, I'm going to do whatever I can to leave my sons some sort of a business. I don't care if it's a grass mowing, a lawn care, or I don't care what it is. I'm going to, you know, their goal was to leave behind some sort of a legacy. So they got the opportunity to purchase a old supermarket that was closing down, very, you know, very small, 1985. And so we got it. They got into that business. And, you know, right off the gate, you know, I was after school, I was, you know, my granddad would pick me up from school and we'd go do inventory at buy products at the local little inventory place and come back and, you know, put little candies on the shelf. And I would, you know, they would always have me in front of the cash register counting and writing little stuff down. That was like my math homework, you know, learning how to add and subtract. So they would take the old Pepsi Cola crates and turn it upside down so I could stand on it to be tall enough to hit the little button, you know, on the cash register.
Yeah.
So that was my, you know, my grandfather was, you know, was my hero as well. So, you know, he taught me all the early points of hard work and just, you know, just spending time.
Right. Hard work, entrepreneurship, family. Yeah. It's all wrapped up in that, right?
All wrapped up.
And then the way your father tells the story, I find this moment to be so important, right? Because
right.
you know, he wanted to help out his mother, who right. was struggling after losing her husband. And
right.
the day that he went over there, if I have the story right, it'd been a slow business day, right? Because she said
very
that
much.
She'd only sold $17 worth of goods that day, and
yeah.
he wanted to, you know, sort of lift her spirits and asked her what he could do. And she said, "I have a taste for some good old fashioned barbecue," and immediately. Mm-hmm. Your father knew exactly what that meant. That seems really yeah. important to me. Yeah.
It does. He knew exactly what she was talking about. It had been a while since we had, you know, had lit the grill or did something like that, cooked a small pig. And so he knew what she meant. And, you know, also in that moment, you know, in his mind, it's, you know, this is, you know, late 80s, early 90s, right, or early 90s. And so losing my grandfather also meant losing a significant, you know, source of income through his retirement. It meant losing his leadership. More importantly, it meant losing his word, you know, with all of, you know, the business and or banking relationships that he had, because he was the type of man that could go into, you know, he can walk into the bank and he makes his deposits and a firm handshake. And, you know, everyone knew, you know, Mr. Willie's word was his word. You know, if he said he's going to bring you back $100 by 5 o'clock, he's going to bring you back $105 by 5 o'clock. And you know? So, you know, back then, you know, relationships were everything. Handshakes were everything. So, you know, his name was just as important, you know, that was just as important of a loss as it was
yeah.
you know, anything else. So my dad was trying to figure out just what, you know, what are we going to do and how.
Mm.
And barbecue, my grandmother's request, you know, for barbecue meant that, you know, she was in one of those modes to where she was going to try and use food you know, another means to sit everybody down and just, you know, think.
Yeah.
And pray.
Yeah. You know. Yeah. And it wasn't just any kind of barbecue that she meant, right? I mean, she meant whole hog cooked over coals.
Yeah, she wanted the grill lit up on the side of wherever it was, but we had it right there on the side of the building. She wanted the grill lit up. She wanted a whole hog barbecue. She wanted it from her particular butcher that was a couple miles up the road. You know, she wanted some oak wood and old-fashioned cooked barbecue. And she wanted them, more importantly, she wanted the opportunity for my dad and my two uncles to, you know, be out there together figuring out, because, you know, the process is still, you know, 8 to 10 hours. So, we started it very, you know, kind of similar.
Yeah.
We figured it out.
So I'm going to tease our listeners a little bit and say that they're going to have to wait until a little later in the show before I ask you, how do you cook the whole hog? I'm not going to ask you to give away all your secrets, but just give us a little 101 in a little bit later in the show. But, sure. You know, the other thing, we've just got about a minute before our first break, mm-hmm. Ryan. From what I understand, I mean, Wilson, North Carolina was already pretty well known for barbecue, but there wasn't a lot of, at that time, commercial places that were selling whole hog cooked over coals. Is that right?
Correct. That's right. That's right. You know, Wilson, North Carolina, the proximity was just perfect because we were like on that corridor of 301 Highway and I-95. So it's kind of like, you know, the sweet spot between New York and or Florida. So everyone knew, the travelers understood that Wilson was kind of that eastern part of Carolinas was the sweet spot to get some good barbecue. But at that time, those larger restaurants had moved over to just high volume cooking because everybody was traveling, and that meant they were getting, you know, different cuts of the pork shoulder and pork butts and not necessarily the whole hog.
And cooked over gas instead of
cooked over
coal.
Yeah, cooked over gas. They were, you know, they were making money and serving a lot of volume, and so that you know, they were answering the call to demand.
Mm. Well, Ryan Mitchell joins us today. He's son of legendary pitmaster and Barbecue Hall of Famer Ed Mitchell. They've co-authored a new cookbook called Ed Mitchell's Barbecue. We'll talk more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Ryan Mitchell joins us today from Raleigh, North Carolina. He's a pitmaster from Wilson, North Carolina, and son of legendary pitmaster and Barbecue Hall of Famer Ed Mitchell. And they've co-authored a new cookbook called Ed Mitchell's Barbecue. And Ryan, I know that your father was supposed to join us today, but couldn't because of health issues. And I just wanted to note that and to let you know that we are sending to you, him, and your family, all the most positive energy we can for your father. So I wanted to ask you a little bit more about once Mitchell's Supermarket became Mitchell's Ribs, Chicken, and Barbecue over the course of those few years. When did you get pulled into the business full time? Or better yet, when did you cook barbecue your first whole hog?
Well, what's also a part of our story that people may or may not know, that we, you know, we all kind of enter this barbecue business hand in hand together, you know, at different ages, you know. And so I was, you know, 13 when my grandfather passed. By the next summer, 14, I was 14 years old going into the next summer. And by then, you know, we were already, you know, kind of, you know, rocking and rolling within a year's time of making the conversion. So I put my first hog on when I was, you know, right around 14 years old that summer, right before I turned 14. And so, you know, I was in the smokehouse with my uncle Aubrey Mitchell, which is my father's brother, obviously. But he, you know, was one of our, you know, one of our lead cooks there at the restaurant as well, cooking barbecue. And so he and I had a, you know, I was playing sports, playing football, and he was my, you know, kind of my sports hero because he was like this, you know, great football player from our city. And so he and I always had this, you know, special relationship when it comes to sports and working out and, you know, making sure I, you know, knew the game. And so he, you know, he took some time with me inside the smokehouse one day and, you know, really kind of a part of a, you know, a workout day slash regiment slash, okay, you know, get your chores done for the day so your dad don't be upset. Mm. And then, you know, kind of get back to whatever it is you want to do for the rest of the day. So I put my first hog on, you know, right at 14 years old. And so, you know, it all worked out. At the, looking back on that day, you know, it really was just kind of a trick for them to kind of get me to do all the work. Cause I was, they were, you know, I was always trying to, you know, show how strong I was and that I could be, you know, one of the big boys or whatever. So I'm grabbing charcoals and whole hogs off the truck and, you know, just showing everybody I don't need them. And so, yeah, yeah, they was like, yeah, go ahead and let them finish it. Yeah, yeah. And so they're just sitting back and letting me, you know, show off, so to say. And lo and behold, I'm tricked into putting on a hog.
Can you talk a little bit about the physicality of the work? I mean, it's not just tending to the coals, but you're dealing with whole hogs.
Yeah, you're dealing with a whole hog. I mean, and you know, the average size hog that we start out with is, you know, somewhere between 100 and 125 pounds. So, you know, it takes a lot of, you know, physical work, you know, and those times, you know, obviously there was no air conditioning in the pits. You know, we're using an outdoor garage pit that we had converted into a smokehouse. So, you know, it is North Carolina summer times, you know, mm-hmm. So we're 90 plus, you know, degrees in the summer and we're, you know, the physicality that goes into, you know, just the prep to even get the hog down on the grill is a tremendous amount of work. You know, there's a lot of easier ways to feed people, but there isn't a more, you know, spiritual / authentic way to feed people.
Uh-huh. Okay. So yeah. Let's hold on to that thought about the authenticity and the spiritual connection, because I definitely want to return to that. But okay. There's also something, though, that your father has written about, which is really, really important, because as you were describing earlier, that first hog that he barbecued for your mm-hmm. grandmother, there was never the intention of like turning it into a business, because he even writes that he never ever considered the possibility of making a living as a pitmaster, because in the community when he grew up, yeah, barbecue was done in that mm-hmm. traditional way for church and things like that. And mm-hmm. and he writes, no one I ever knew actually owned anything and had ever made a career out of being a pitmaster. All the black men I knew had to stay in the back, cook, and keep their heads down. They weren't even allowed to own businesses.
That's right. That's correct. You know, that is also a part of, you know, the complexity that we have, you know, just as people of color with, you know, barbecue is a, you know, small microcosm of the overall world of hospitality. But, you know, being a pit master, you know, our reputation of being able to cook good barbecue started, you know, in the 1800s. Okay, so, you know, the context that didn't make this particular book is that we also were able to verify, you know, the childhood rumor for me that my great-grandfather had fathered 35 children. So he fathered 35 children between two wives, and so, you know, roughly 1870 all the way up through my dad's, you know, childhood and adult life, our family and different sectors of our family were all, you know, known to be really good at cooking barbecue and or, you know, all the things that come along with sharecropping and the tobacco harvest. We were just very involved as a family with all these different, you know, facets of, you know, Carolina agriculture, you know, through work. So the pits and the former plantations and even the restaurants that had grown a decent reputation at that time, you know, the pits were all manned by, you know, African-American pit masters, and, you know, the name on the marquee was different. Mm-hmm. So we didn't have that experience with, you know, seeing someone be successful at it as it relates to progressing into some form of ownership, and, you know, and that all relates to just the complex nature of remaining in, you know, the service industry side of it too. So, but there were a few sweet spots for Black Americans during that time, and to enter entrepreneurship, and just so happened, you know, forms of service, i.e., you know, opening up a small, you know, restaurant of some sorts, or, you know, some sort of you know, mechanics and lawn cares, and you know trades. You know, there were some acceptable entry points in to trying to become an entrepreneur of some sorts. And so, you know, we were able to find that sweet spot, but it wasn't because we, you know, had any examples before.
Yeah. I would love to hear you tell the story of how your interest was renewed in having a deeper understanding of the historical significance of whole hog barbecue, because it's kind of an amazing thing that it happens because a certain gentleman, which people might have heard of, named Anthony Bourdain, enters
Absolutely.
The scene.
Very much so, very much so. You know, there's articles out there on how I, you know, ignored his emails and phone calls and just totally just, you know, dissed this guy. But I had no, I didn't know who he was, and my family didn't. Only two people in my family understood what was happening with Food Network and the popularity of food, and so they were aware of him. But, you know, in 2002, you know, obviously I grew up in the restaurant business, so I'm working, and I'm a young man trying to figure out, you know, why is it, you know, we're really good at this, we have our name on this building, we're doing well, but I just could not make the connectivity on why we're continuing to be in the service industry, we're continuing to do these things, we're not making a whole lot of money, but we're doing a great service to the community by chasing the dream. You know, my grandmother grew up working on plantation homes, so her story about food and beverage was, you know, were not the greatest until she, you know, started talking to me about how she poured that energy back into her home and why she cooked so much at home. You know, it was almost therapeutic for her to deal with what she was going through during the daytime to give that energy back to her family. Again, fast forward to my parents' generation, you know, wining and dining around the city or around the country wasn't, you know, fashionable then, because they weren't actually allowed to eat in a lot of these restaurants.
Exactly.
And have that experience or positivity with food and beverage or barbecue at that time. The pit masters around all the places that might have been your favorite that you could maybe go in the back door of were all working in the kitchen. And so the presentation of barbecue in the hospitality industry was just something that I was, you know, struggling with and trying to understand. And then along comes, so I get through high school, college, and my first year out of college, along comes this gentleman named Antonio Bourdain. And he is, you know, on his second season of a show called Cook's Tour, which is the memoirs from his book. And he comes in and, you know, after all of my, you know, deleted emails, you know, he finally gets the call through to the secretary and catering secretary. And she comes running down like, do you not know, you know, who the heck this gentleman is? I was like, man, no, I don't know. But what I do know is that, like, we got a couple hours to get the money up for the light bill. And, you know, the line is out the door. We're running out of product. I don't have time for these this camera nonsense. You know, I'm trying to make a living. And it doesn't even, you know, I have no context of anyone being, you know, that interested in what it is we're doing from a entertainment perspective. And so Antonio comes in, and I'll never forget, you know, he, you know, after a couple hours of shooting, you know, he notices me, you know, because I'm not on camera, I'm off camera, you know, kind of making sure my dad and my uncles and everybody get the limelight, and I'm making sure all the business is handled. And he notices my, you know, quote unquote disconnect, but my stress with, you know, how what we're doing. He, you know, he has a very candid conversation with me, and you know, was polite enough and brotherly enough to be, you know, to enlighten me just on what it is we had here and how important, you know, our place was in barbecue to the culture. And he said to me directly, he said, you know, I met you guys at the Big Apple Block Party. He said, but the reason that I chose you to be on this show is because I did my homework and I was very adamant with my production team that I wanted the guy who whose name was on the building. I also wanted to see if he worked in the pits. Uh-huh. And so he said, when I verified that the same name that was in that smokehouse working and doing all the work was the same name on the building, he said, I made it my business, you know, to make sure that I spoke and brought my my interest in this show here to you. He said, so you have something that that wasn't commonplace, right? And so his ability to explain that to me and to kind of, you know, just see him, he said, I travel all over the world, you know, eating food and enjoying different cultures. You know, he said, I could be anywhere, he said, but, you know, I'm here. And that was my, you know, kind of coming to Jesus moment, if you will, on what it is we were doing and who and why, you know, people were interested in it.
Yeah.
And so.
Yeah. You know, so that sets you on this path of, first of all, not only just more deeply recognizing what you and your family had for sure,
right,
but
right.
then also this bigger story, the deeper story of, and you've mentioned it a couple of times, of Black America and hospitality and barbecue. Mm-hmm. In particular, mm-hmm. I want to hear a little bit more from you about what you discovered, not only about your family, but about that complex relationship to hospitality that you've been talking about.
Yeah, I mean, it's you know, barbecue, like I say, is just really a small, you know, small microcosm into this bigger picture, but. You can't talk about barbecue without talking about the farm, and you can't reference the farm without also referencing, you know, time and place of plantation life and, you know, cooking and being under those conditions of servitude while we were building this cuisine that serves America, you know. So, you know, Black pit masters are, you know, we have, you know, the authentic love, you know, for the craft, but it is very hard to, you know, maintain that intense sense of labor, you know, as you try to figure out how to be in the business of it. And so sometimes, you know, we do, you know, different emotions come out, you know, when it comes to doing that type of work. And, you know, you have to reflect and understand that there's a bigger picture. And so we were able to kind of embrace some of that. And it all really kind of starts with understanding that, you know, barbecue is, you know, it's a craft that happened. It's a skill set that was also mastered well before, you know, we got to America. You know, these skill sets, once we started traveling, we traveled to Melbourne, Australia, we traveled to Brazil, and we cooked in these barbecue festivals. And you start learning, you know, the culture of the craft, you know, starts with all forms of indigenous cultures around the world. And so getting to the, you know, Americas and continuing to cook in the ground and continuing this art form, you know, was something that, you know, it's a worldly thing. And so now you have to, now you learn how to appreciate, you know, your contributions to it and what it means to you and move forward that way.
Yeah.
And so, but the bigger picture is the way in which we classify who is good and who is great has evolved into who wins competitions and or who owns, who has the longevity in successful restaurants. And so that kind of undercuts, you know, the recognition that certain Black Americans can get with maintaining their position in barbecue because, you know, we have turned it into a sport almost.
Oh, I see what you mean. Okay, so mm-hmm. that overshadows the opportunity or even sounds like the obligation to understand the history of this very food that we're consuming.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, so, you know, we just have to work on how we who we call great and who we start recognizing. And because, you know, the opportunity and the resources available for most African Americans to start, you know, business and maintain successful run, a successful long-term run in any, you know, food space is, you know, it's challenging. And mm-hmm. so, you know, once you start to only recognize it from that angle, then you, you know, by default, you know, disconnect a certain group of people.
Right. Well, I think your example shows us all, which is why I'm so glad that, to be talking to you today about, Ryan, about how, like, really understanding that history and honoring mm-hmm. it can then turn into a celebration of what we're all enjoying together now. So when we come back, we're going to dig a little bit deeper into the history and the cultural roots of barbecue, as you described, Ryan. So just stick with us and we'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and I want to just take a minute to give you a preview of what we're working on for next week. Once when I was a kid, I saw a guy from NASA give a talk, and he was so enthusiastic about what he did. He ended up saying during this talk that he's like, I love my job so much, I essentially get paid to do my passion, to work my hobby. And I thought when I was like 10 years old, that's what I want my job to be like. Are you one of those folks? I mean, did you grow up thinking that you would pursue your passion and find your calling or even your meaning at work? I'm asking because next week we're going to talk about that and how things are actually changing for many people who once thought work would be a major source of their identity. So what do you think now about the idea of pursuing a dream job or finding your meaning in your employment? Is it time for us to step back from that and look at work as fundamentally more transactional? And should we be seeking meaning outside of our jobs? So that's what we're going to be talking about next week, and we would love to hear you on this. So send us your thoughts by recording a message in the On Point Vox Pop app. If you don't have it already, look for On Point Vox Pop wherever you get your apps. You can also just call us if you want at 617-353-0683. That's for next week. Today, we are speaking with Ryan Mitchell. He's a pitmaster from Wilson, North Carolina, and son of legendary pitmaster and Barbecue Hall of Famer Ed Mitchell. They've co-authored a new cookbook called Ed Mitchell's Barbecue. And Ryan, I want to just take a moment to talk more about that, you know, centuries-long history of barbecue and why, as you've been describing, there's this complicated relationship that Black America has with the whole concept of not family hospitality or community hospitality, but hospitality and work. So we reached out to someone who knows a lot about this and asked him, when does the American tradition of barbecue really begin? Because what's commonly recognized as the Southern pit barbecue, he said, dates back to the 1500s.
Probably Virginia is where barbecue started. I think that's the strongest case for barbecue, because the indigenous people there would dig a shallow pit in the ground. They would fill it with a combination of rocks and wood, and they would set the wood on fire. And then they would just put strips of meat either on the rocks and woods itself, or they would lay sticks across the depression that they created by digging that shallow pit and put the meat on that.
Adrian Miller is a James Beard Award-winning culinary historian and the author of Black Smoke, African Americans, and the United States of Barbecue.
So that looks familiar to what would eventually become Southern barbecue. And then later, colonizing Europeans and enslaved Africans bring their own meat cooking traditions and techniques. And then there's this collaboration that develops that puts us on the road to Southern barbecue.
Miller says for centuries, that original style of barbecue typically involved cooking a whole animal, a pig, as we've been discussing. Over time, barbecue naturally became a popular menu item for special occasions. After all, when you cook a whole hog in the era before refrigeration, the food needs to be finished fast.
You know, if there was a public works project, somebody was going to build a dam or complete a railway or start a new road or something, they'd have a barbecue. Politicians figured out, hey, if I have a barbecue, I can get people to come hear me give a stump speech and eat my barbecue and maybe even vote for me, although that didn't always happen, and they knew that. And then preachers figured it out, too. They would have these big multi-day religious revivals that they called camp meetings, and barbecue was often a feature of that. And then in slavery, for enslaved people, barbecue was definitely a way to connect people socially and reinforce those social ties.
Miller also says cooking the barbecue was extremely labor-intensive.
Chop the wood, put it in that trench, set it on fire, wait till it burned down as coals. Then somebody had to butcher the animals, process them, butterfly them, stick poles in them, and then somebody had to cook these animals by flipping them periodically. Another person had to maintain a separate fire of hardwood burning coals, and they would just walk up and down the pit looking for cold spots. And then somebody else had a bucket with vinegar and spices to sauce the meat. And then other people had to practice their instruments because they were the after barbecue entertainment. They would play music and dance. Somebody had to serve the food and somebody had to clean all this stuff up. And for much of barbecue's history, that work fell upon enslaved Africans and the later enslaved African Americans. Because the racial dynamic of our country is if you're going to have somebody do a lot of work and not pay them, you had enslaved Black people do it. So by the time you get to the 19th century, and really towards the end of the 18th century, Blackness and barbecue are wedded.
And that held true even after emancipation and the end of the Civil War. Not only because of the role that barbecue played in connecting Black Americans together, but also because the appetite for good barbecue never went away. In fact, Miller told us that Black Americans became the undisputed experts of the cuisine, and they set up brick-and-mortar shops around the country during the urbanization of America in the 1920s.
And I would say that soul food, fried fish places, and barbecue were probably the three most popular types of businesses that African Americans ran in terms of the food space.
Barbecue has been many things for Black Americans throughout history, from the forced labor of enslaved people to one of the early opportunities for entrepreneurial success. And throughout it all, Miller says it's been an important means of connecting the Black community.
Cooking is an expression of love. You know, somebody is saying that they care for your survival. Even if the food is straight nasty, the act of cooking is meaningful. But these food traditions connect us to a past. And we have a lot more in common in that past than we may think. A lot of people that go into a barbecue restaurant today just enjoy it as a type of food. They may have no idea of its history. But one of the joys that I found in sharing my work with others is people start to see these connections. They're like, oh, wow, Native American and its foundation. And then you've got enslaved Africans and Europeans. So these shared cuisines in a shared past, I think, inform our present and help us endeavor to have a shared future.
That's Adrian Miller. He's a James Beard Award-winning culinary historian and the author of Black Smoke, African Americans, and the United States of Barbecue. Well, Ryan, can you tell me more about what you found and put in, in the cookbook as you and your father were doing some research for it that connects to this? Because, for example, you found articles from what, the 1800s, the 19th century, that described, you know, how plantation owners allowed sharecroppers to occasionally use the barns as gathering places.
Absolutely. I mean, that was, you know, spot on by Adrian. You know, we did an intense amount of research just trying to backtrack some of the stories from my family, like some of the things that we were hearing, you know, that I grew up hearing as a kid, and you know, that were folklore through my parents and grandparents. And so we were able to find articles of shindigs from the Wilson Daily Times, whereas one of the plantations that was connected in our story, not too far from where we live, in a town called Stantonburg, North Carolina, which is right near my high school. There was a story in the Wilson Daily Times where that weekend, you know, they were writing about a separate tragedy because an incident had happened. But in that story was the relationship between a plantation owner and one of the sharecroppers or enslaved African-Americans that was there. He had developed a relationship with him to where on the weekends or at the end of, you know, work and harvest, one of the barns was allowed to be used as a gathering place, as like a form of camaraderie for all the other African-Americans on the plantation or in the area. And the shindig specifically, detailed the menu, which was whole hog chopped barbecue. Mm. And it says likely seasoned by vinegar and crushed red peppers. Now, the reason that was so important to us because it was one of the first pieces to identify not just the use of eating good barbecue, but using the cuisine as a form of business. Mm-hmm. So he would, you know, charge, you know, 10 cent a sandwich or whatever the rate was. And he would sell, barbecue at this shindig, and there would be music playing. And it was almost a form of entertainment and or the first, you know, form of really entrepreneurship, you know, that the hog provided. Because, again, you're cooking a whole hog. That is a very easy way to feed and invite large, you know, groups of people.
Yeah. Survival even is how you call it, right?
Survival, yeah. You know, that it's a survival food, you know. And so, you know, those stories were truly important for us to really connect to and kind of put some credence to. And they were right there in our archives, in our newspaper.
Yeah. Can I ask another quick thing? Because I did not know this, that on the Underground Railroad, people would learn how to cook barbecue because doing whole hog barbecue in the ground was a safer way of cooking?
Well, yeah. Like, so one of the unique points that Adrian was also mentioning from the, you know, 1500s about how, you know, indigenous Americans and African Americans were digging pits in the ground and, you know, with fire and rocks and learning the technique of cooking underground, so to say. So there was documentation, whereas, on the road to freedom, the technique of building small pits in the ground and cooking small entire animals in the ground was also a method of hiding the smoke, right? Uh-huh. So as opposed to cooking it, you know, above ground or in another type of a pit or in another type of contraption or whatever, you would put the food underground and you would cover it and it would cook and simmer on its own. And, you know, the leaves and the barriers and all the things that they would use to compress it would also hide the smoke. So you weren't able to see or identify, a dead giveaway of where, you know, someone was cooking at in order to eat on the run.
Mm, okay.
You know, so... you know, all of these techniques, that are associated with learning how to cook barbecue, you're cooking it to survive on the run. You're cooking it to feed gatherings, and functions, and you're cooking it to stay alive. Yeah. And there's so many different facets on, you know, how, you know, we connect to it.
Exactly. Well, we've only got a couple of minutes left, Ryan, and I got to come clean with you about something.
Okay.
I was a little nervous to have this conversation because I am super aware that, I'm having a conversation with a pit master, and I sit up here in Boston, Massachusetts, where we dig holes and throw clams into them. So, I can't say that I know anything about barbecue. And also, we've got listeners in the Carolinas, in Texas, mm-hmm. in a lot of states where there is extreme barbecue passion. So I'm throwing my hands up and admitting I am a total novice when it comes to barbecue. So give me a little lesson. Like, where do you start if you want to learn how to do a whole hog?
Well, you know, we have first and foremost, you know, we have much easier ways and more efficient ways now than opposed to digging a pit in the ground. So, you know, if you I would advise all, you know, new whole hog barbecue guys, the first thing you want to do is find you a nice barrel smoker, you know, and you know, a barrel drum or a smoker that's, you know, shaped in the rectangular form. Okay. Understanding that, you know, your first hog needs to be somewhere between, we'll just say 50 and 75 pounds, just so you can kind of, you know, get the hang of, you know, what it's going to take to get this animal done, right? And so there's a process that we use, and it's called banking. And what banking is that you position your coals and your heat in a rectangular form inside of your smoker so that the shoulders and the hams are able to get done at the same time as the middle part of the hog is, which is where the most tender pieces of meat are that don't need an intense amount of direct heat. So a barrel drum, you know, a bag of charcoal, hickory and or oak wood, we prefer, as your heat source. And, you know, start with your local butcher, start with your local farmer's market and go source, you know, one of the most, you know, pasture raised, you know, well-fed animals that you can, mm-hmm. that you can find, support your small farmer in that aspect. And, you know, you light your grill, you light your smoker, get your coals going up to about, you know, about 275, 300, and put your grates down and you put your hog down skin side up. Mm. And you shut the lid, because if you're looking, you're not cooking, okay? Uh-huh. So you shut the lid and you trust the process. On that size of an animal, you know, you're probably only going to need about 6 hours, 7 hours at the most. So, you know, that can give you a great introduction to at least giving it a shot. And while it's cooking, you know, you find you, if my dad was on here, he'd say, go find you also a nice legal but maybe illegal jug of moonshine that you can get from someone, all right? And you fill that up with half and half sweet tea and moonshine, and you sit there and you think about, you know, how good the food is going to be and who you want to be your first taste tester.
Yeah, you hit up your local home brewer.
Local home brewer up, man.
What are you seasoning with? Is your sauce a secret sauce?
Sauce is a secret sauce, but it's not. Listen, we are, you know, vinegar-based, chopped whole hog barbecue, crushed red pepper, and vinegar-based, apple cider vinegar specifically, is what we call Carolina barbecue. It's what we call barbecue in general. So once your animal gets done, you're going to need a jug of apple cider vinegar and some crushed red pepper and a little bit of hot sauce and maybe some salt and pepper, sage, paprika. I think that's on page, 14 of the book, mm-hmm, or something, mm-hmm. like that. But, you know, it's got to be some vinegar involved.
Yeah. And then
the vinegar it's a multifaceted ingredient and it has its own history.
Yeah. And then you bring your family and your friends and your community together, and you just come together over the barbecue.
You just come together and you turn them over, and you just find the best pieces that look done, and you just give it a taste, give it a shot. Well, and you do that over and over and over again, yeah, until you get it right.
Well, Ryan Mitchell is the son of legendary pitmaster Ed Mitchell, and their new cookbook is Ed Mitchell's Barbecue. Brian, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.